one of those. Greer handed him Winfield's pistol. I'll explain on the way. Peter, Apgar, and Chase were looking over Michael's passenger manifest when shouts erupted in the hall. Put it down! Put it down! A crash. A gunshot. Peter reached into his desk for the pistol he kept there. Gunner, what have you got? Nothing. Ford? The man shook his head. Get behind my desk. The handle of the door jiggled. Peter and Apgar took positions against the wall on either side. The wood shuddered. Somebody was kicking it. The door blew open. As the first man entered, Apgar tackled him from behind. A shotgun skittered away. Apgar pinned him with his knees, one hand on his throat, the other lifted, ready to strike. He stopped.
Greer?
Hello, General.
Michael,
Peter said, lowering his gun.
What the fuck?
Three soldiers charged into the room, rifles drawn.
Hold your fire,
Peter yelled. With visible uncertainty, the soldiers complied.
What was that gunshot outside, Michael?
The man waved casually. Oh, he missed. We're fine. Peter was shaking with anger.
You three, he said to the soldiers, clear the room.
They made their departure. Apgar climbed off Greer. Chase, meanwhile, had come out from behind Peter's desk. Michael gestured in Chase's direction. Is he okay?
In what sense?
I mean, does he know?
Yeah, Chase said tersely. I know.
Peter was still furious.
The two of you. What do you think you're doing?
Under the circumstances, we thought a direct approach was best, Greer replied. We have a vehicle outside. We need you to come with us, Peter, and we need to leave right now. Peter's patience was at its end.
I'm not going anywhere. You don't start talking sense. I'll toss your asses in the stockade myself and throw away the key.
I'm afraid the situation has changed.
So the virals aren't coming back after all? This is all some kind of joke.
I'm afraid it's the opposite, Greer said. They're already here. 53. Amy was going to miss this place. They had decided to leave the rest of their chores undone for the day. There seemed no point in finishing them now. Sometimes, Carter told her, you got to let a garden tend itself.
She felt sick, almost feverish. Could she control it? Would she kill him?
And what of the water?
You got to do it the way Zero done,
Carter had told her. Ain't no other way to go back to the way you were. The girls were watching a movie in the house. It was one Amy remembered from being just a girl herself, The Wizard of Oz. The movie had terrified her. The tornado, the field of poppies, the wicked witch with her sickly green skin and battalion of airborne monkeys in bellman's hats. But she had also loved it. Amy had watched it in the motel where she and her mother had lived. Her mother would put on her little skirt and stretchy top to go out to the highway. And before she left, she'd sit Amy down in front of the television with something to eat, something greasy in a bag, and tell her, you sit tight now. Mama will be back soon. Don't you open that door for nobody. Amy could see the guilt in her mother's eyes. She understood that leaving a child by herself wasn't something her mother was supposed to do. And Amy's heart always went out to her, because she loved her. And the woman was so remorseful and sad all the time, as if life was a series of disappointments she could do nothing to stop. Sometimes her mother could barely get out of bed all day, and then night would fall, and the skirt and the top and the television would go on, and she'd leave Amy alone again. The night of The Wizard of Oz had been their last in the motel, or so Amy recalled. She'd watched cartoons for a while, and when these were over, a game show. And then she flipped around the dial until the movie caught her eye. The colors were odd, too vivid. That was the first thing she noticed. Lying on the bed, which smelled like her mother, a melange of sweat and perfume, and something distinctly her own. Amy settled in to watch. She entered the story when Dorothy, having rescued her dog from the clutches of the evil Miss Gulch, was racing from the storm. The tornado whisked her away. She found herself in the land of the Munchkins, who sang about their happy lives. But of course there was the problem of the feet. The feet of the Wicked Witch of the East, sticking out from beneath Dorothy's tornado-driven house. It went on from there. Her attention was complete. She understood Dorothy's desire to go home. That was the heart of the story, and it made sense to Amy. She hadn't been home in a long time. She barely remembered it, just a shadowy sense of certain rooms. As the movie drew to a close, and Dorothy clicked her heels together and awoke in the bosom of her family, Amy decided to try this. She had no ruby slippers, but her mother had a pair of boots, very tall, with pointed heels. Amy slid them on. They rose up her skinny little girl legs nearly to her crotch. The heels were very high, making it difficult to walk. She took tender steps around the room to get the hang of it, and when she felt comfortable, she closed her eyes and tapped the heels together three times. There's no place like home. There's no place like home. There's no place like home. So convinced was she of the magical power of this gesture that when she opened her eyes, she was shocked to discover that nothing had happened. She was still in the motel, with its dirty carpet and dull, immovable furniture. She yanked off the boots, hurled them across the room, threw herself down on the bed, and began to cry. She must have fallen asleep, because the next thing she saw was her mother's frightened face looming over her. She was shaking Amy roughly by the shoulder. Her top was stained and torn. "Come on now, honey," her mother said. "Wake up now, baby. We got to go, right now." Carter was skimming the pool. The first leaves were falling, crisp and brown. "I thought we were taking the day off," Amy said. "We are. Just gotta get these here. Bothers me seeing them." She was sitting on the patio. Inside, the girls had reached the part of the movie where Dorothy and her companions entered the Emerald City. "They should turn it down a bit," Carter remarked. He was dragging the skimmer along the edges, trying to work some small bit of debris into the net. "Girls are going to wreck their ears." Yes, she would miss it here. The softness of the place, its cool feeling of green, the small tasks that filled their days of waiting. Carter laid the skimmer on the pool deck and took a chair across from her. They listened to the movie for a while. When the Wicked Witch melted, the girls erupted in happy shrieks. "How many times they watched that?" Carter asked. "Oh, quite a few. When I was a boy, seemed like it was on TV about half the time. Scared the wits out of me." Carter paused. "I always did like that movie, though." They loaded the Humvee with cans of fuel. Sitting in the cargo compartment were plastic bins of supplies Greer had brought with him. Rope and tackle, a spinner net, a pair of wrenches, blankets, a simple cotton frock. "I'd be happier if we could bring Sarah along," Peter said. "She'd know better than any of us what to do." Greer heaved a jug over the tailgate. "Not a good idea at this point. We need to keep the number of people to a minimum." "We have to get word out to the townships," Peter told Apgar. "People need to take shelter. Basements, interior rooms, whatever they've got. In the morning we can send out vehicles to bring as many back as we can." "I'll see to it." Peter glanced at Chase. "Ford, you've got the chair."
"Understood."
Peter addressed Apgar again.
"My son and his family."
The general didn't let him finish. "I'll radio the detachment in Luckenbach. We'll get some men out there. Caleb's got a hard box on the property. I'll pass that along." Greer was waiting at the wheel, Michael riding shotgun. Peter climbed in back. "Let's go," he said. It was 18:30. The sun would set in 2 hours.
54.
Sarah and Hollis were making good time. They had entered the zone everybody called the Gap, a stretch of empty road between Ingram and Hunt Township. They were hugging the Guadalupe now, which gurgled pleasantly in the shallows. Fat live oaks stretched their canopies over the roadway. Then they came to an open stretch, the low sun in their faces. Then more trees and shade.
"I think this guy needs a break," Sarah said.
They dismounted and led the horses to the edge of the river. Standing on the bank, Hollis's mare dipped her long face to the water without hesitation, but the gelding seemed uncertain. Sarah removed her boots, rolled up her pants, and led him into the shallows to drink. The water was wonderfully cold, the river bottom made of smooth limestone, firm underfoot. After the horses had drunk their fill, Sarah and Hollis took a moment to let the animals wander. The two of them sat on a rocky outcrop that jutted over the edge of the water. The vegetation on the banks was thick, willows, pecans, oaks, a scrub of mesquites and prickly pears. Evening insects were hatching from the water in ascending motes of light. 100 yards upstream, the river paused in a wide, deep pool.
"It's so peaceful out here," Sarah said.
Hollis nodded, his face full of contentment.
"I think I could get used to this."
She was thinking of a certain place in the past. It was many years ago, when she and Hollis and all the others had traveled east with Amy to Colorado. Theo and Mouse were gone by this time, left behind at the farmstead so Mouse could have her baby. They'd crossed the La Salle Range and descended to a wide valley of tall grass and blue skies and stopped to rest. In the distance, snow-capped, the peaks of the Rockies loomed, though the air was still mild. Sitting in the shade of a maple tree, Sarah had experienced a feeling she'd never really had before, a sense of the world's beauty. Because it really was beautiful. The trees, the light, the way the grass moved in the breeze, the mountains glinting faces of ice. How had she failed to notice these things before? And if she had, why had they seemed different, more ordinary, less charged with life? She had fallen in love with Hollis, and she understood, sitting under the maple tree with her friends around her. Michael had, in fact, fallen asleep, hugging his shotgun over his chest like a child's stuffed animal. But Hollis was the reason. It was love, and only love, that opened your eyes.
"We better go," Hollis said. "It'll be dark soon."
They gathered the horses and rode on. General Gunnar Apgar, standing at the top of the wall, watched the shadows stretching over the valley. He glanced at his watch. 20:15 hours. Sunset was minutes away. The last transports bringing workers in from the fields were churning up the hill. All of his men had taken up positions along the top of the wall. They had new guns and fresh ammunition, but their numbers were small, far too few to watch every inch of a 6-mile perimeter, let alone defend it. Apgar wasn't a religious man. Many years had passed since a prayer had found his lips, though it made him feel a little foolish. He decided to say one now. "God," he thought, "if you're listening, sorry about the language, but if it's not too much trouble, please let this all be bullshit." Footsteps banged down the catwalk toward him.
"What is it, Corporal?"
The soldier's name was Ratcliffe, a radio operator. He was badly winded from his run up the stairs. He bent at the waist and put his hands on his knees, taking in great gulps of air between words.
"General, sir, we got the message out like you said."
"How about Luckenbach?"
Ratcliffe nodded quickly, still looking at the ground.
"Yeah, they're sending a squad."
He paused and coughed.
"But that's the thing. They were the only ones who answered."
"Catch your breath, Corporal."
"Yes, sir. Sorry, sir."
"Now tell me what you're talking about."
The soldier drew himself erect.
"It's just like I said. Hunt, Comfort, Bernie, Rosenberg. We're not getting anything back. No acknowledgement, nothing.
Every station except Luckenbach is offline.
The last bus was passing through the gate. Below, in the staging area, workers were filing off. Some were talking, telling jokes, and laughing. Others separated themselves quickly from the group and marched away, headed home for the night.
Thanks for passing that along, Corporal.
Apgar watched him totter away before turning to look over the valley again. A curtain of darkness was sweeping over the fields.
Well, he thought, I guess that's that.
It would have been nice if it could have lasted longer.
He descended the stairs and walked to the base of the gate. Two soldiers were waiting with a civilian, a man of about 40, dressed in stained coveralls and holding a wrench the size of a sledgehammer. The man spat a wad of something onto the ground.
Gate should be working fine now, General. I got everything well greased, too. The thing will be quiet as a cat.
Apgar looked at one of the soldiers.
Are all the transports in?
As far as we know.
He tipped his face to the sky. The first stars had appeared, winking from the darkness.
Okay, gentlemen, he said. Let's lock it up.
Caleb was sitting on the front stoop, watching the night come on. That afternoon, he'd inspected the hard box, which he hadn't looked at in months. He'd built it only to please his father. It had seemed silly at the time. Tornadoes happened, yes. Some people had even been killed. But what were the chances? Caleb had cleared the hatch of leaves and other debris and descended the ladder. The interior was cool and dark. A kerosene lantern and jugs of fuel stood along one wall, the hatch sealed from the inside with a pair of steel crossbars. When Caleb had shown the shelter to Pym, their second night at the farm, he'd felt a little embarrassed by the thing, which seemed like an expensive and unwarranted indulgence, completely out of step with the optimism of their enterprise. But Pym had taken it in stride.
"Your father knows a thing or two," she signed. "Stop apologizing. I'm glad you took the time."
Now, looking west, Caleb took measure of the sun. Its bottom edge was just kissing the top of the ridgeline. In its final moments, it appeared to accelerate as it always did. Going, going, gone. He felt the air change. Everything around him seemed to stop. But in the next instant, something caught his eye, a rustling, high in a pecan tree at the edge of the woods. What was he seeing? Not birds. The motion was too heavy. He got to his feet. A second tree shuddered, then a third. He recalled a phrase from the past. When they come from above. He had levered around into the chamber of his rifle when, behind him, in the house, a voice cried out his name.
"Hold up a second," Hollis said. An army truck was tipped on its side in the roadway. One of its back wheels was still spinning with a creaking sound. Sarah quickly dismounted. "Somebody might be hurt." Hollis followed her to the truck. The cab was empty.
"Maybe they walked out of here," Hollis said.
"No, this just happened."
She looked down the road, then pointed.
"There."
The soldier was lying on his back. He was breathing in quick bursts, eyes open, staring at the sky. Sarah dropped to her knees beside him.
"Soldier, look at me. Can you speak?"
He was acting like a man who was badly injured. Yet there was no blood, no obvious sign of anything broken. The sleeves of his uniform bore the two stripes of a corporal. He rolled his face toward her, exposing a small wound, bright with blood, at the base of his throat.
"Run," he croaked.
Caleb burst into the house. Pym was holding Theo, backing away from the door to Dory's room. Bug and Elle were clustered at her legs. Kate's voice.
"Caleb, come quick!"
Dory was thrashing on the bed, spittle spewing from her lips. With a sound like a sneeze, her teeth flew from her mouth. Kate was standing by the bed, holding the revolver.
"Shoot her!"
Caleb yelled. Kate seemed not to hear him.
With a sickening crunch, Dory's fingers elongated, gleaming claws extending from their tips. Her body had begun to glow. Her jaw unlocked, her mouth opened wide, revealing the picketed teeth.
"Shoot her now!"
Kate was frozen in place. As Caleb raised the rifle, Dory jolted upright, rolled into a crouch, and sprang toward the two of them. A confusion of bodies, Dory crashing into Kate, Kate crashing into Caleb. The rifle spat from his hand and skittered across the floor. On his hands and knees, Caleb scrambled toward it. He was yelling for Pym to run, though of course the woman couldn't hear him. His hand found the weapon, and he rolled onto his back. Kate was pushing herself backward toward the opposite wall. Dory stood above her, jaws flexing, fingers extended, strumming the air. Caleb lifted his back off the floor, widened his knees, and leveled the rifle at her with both hands.
"Dory Tatum!"
At the sound of her name, she stiffened, as if struck by a curious thought.
"You're Dory Tatum. Phil is your husband. Look at me."
She turned toward him, exposing her upper body. One shot, thought Caleb, taking the center of her chest into his sights. And then he squeezed the trigger. The soldier began to shake. The motion began at his fingers, which bent into claw-like shapes, like the talons of a hawk. A groan poured from deep in his throat. The shaking hardened into a whole body convulsion, his spine arcing, spittle boiling to his lips. Sarah was on her feet and backing away. She knew what she was seeing. It seemed impossible. And yet it was happening before her eyes. She sensed movement above her, yet she could not tear her eyes away from the soldier, whose transformation was occurring with unheard-of speed.
"Sarah, come on! We have to get out of here!"
One of the horses whinnied and tore past her. It made it all of 50 feet down the road before a glowing shape swooped down and knocked it off its feet. Jaws tore into the horse's neck with a ripping sound. Sarah's mind snapped back into a wider awareness. Hollis was pulling her by the wrist.
"The river!" he yelled. "We have to get to the river!"
With a hard yank, he hauled her into the cover of the trees. They began to run. Shapes bounded above them, limb to limb. Branches whipped her face and arms. Where was the river, their salvation? Sarah could hear it, but could not locate it in the dark.
"Jump!"
In midair, she realized what was happening. They had leapt from a cliff. As she hit the surface, a new, deeper darkness, the darkness of water, enveloped her. It seemed she would never stop descending, but at last her feet touched the bottom. She pushed off and shot to the surface.
"Hollis!"
She twisted in the water, blindly searching.
"Hollis, where are you?"
"Over here. Keep your voice down." She was spinning frantically, trying to locate the source of the voice.
"I can't find you."
"Stay where you are." Hollis appeared, treading water beside her. "Are you hurt?" Was she? She took stock of her body. She didn't think she was.
"What's happening? Where did they come from?"
"I don't know."
"Don't leave me."
"Breathe, Sarah." She fought to calm herself. In, out. In, out. "It looks like there are pockets at the base of the cliff," Hollis said. "We're going to swim there. Can you do it?" She nodded. The water was freezing. Her teeth had begun to chatter. "Stay close." With a smooth breaststroke, he glided away, Sarah following. The cliff took form above her. It wasn't as tall as she'd thought, perhaps 20 feet, and irregularly shaped, with blocky protrusions of pale limestone cantilevered over the pool. The water became shallower. Sarah realized she could stand. Hollis guided her beneath an outcrop. A flat-topped boulder rose above the surface of the water. Hollis helped her up.
"We should be safe here for the night," he said.
Shivering, Sarah leaned against him. Hollis put his arm around her and drew her close. She thought of her children, out there in the dark. She buried her face in Hollis's chest and began to cry. Dory melted to the ground like a puppet cut from its strings. Caleb stepped over the body. Kate was still propped against the wall, her body inert, numbed by shock and fear.
"There's more out there," Caleb said. "We have to get to the shelter."
She looked at him with an unfocused gaze.
"Kate, snap out of it!"
He couldn't wait. He grabbed her by the wrist and shoved her out the door. Pim was huddled by the hearth with the children. She hadn't heard the shot, but he knew she had felt it, shuddering through the frame of the house. Caleb signed a single word. "Go." He dropped the rifle and scooped Elle and Bug into his arms, balancing them on the points of his hips. Pim was carrying Theo. They raced out the back door into the yard. Pim was ahead of him, Kate behind. The darkness was coming alive. The crowns of the trees tossed as if by the wind of an approaching storm. Pim and Theo reached the shelter first. Caleb dropped the girls to their feet and hauled the door of the hard box open. Pim scrambled down the ladder and raised her arms to take Theo and then the girls, Caleb following. At the top of the ladder, he stopped. Kate was standing 30 feet away.
"Kate, come on!"
She drew her collar aside. At the base of her throat, a wound had bloomed with blood. Caleb's stomach dropped. All sensation left him.
"Shut the door," she said.
She was holding the revolver.
He couldn't move. "Caleb, please."
She collapsed to her knees. A deep tremor shook her body. She was cradling the gun in her lap, attempting to lift it. She rocked her head skyward as a second jolt moved through her.
"I'm begging you," she sobbed. "If you love me, shut the door."
His windpipe clamped. He could barely breathe. Behind her, shapes were dropping from the trees. Caleb reached above his head, taking the handle in his grip.
"I'm sorry," he whispered.
He drew down the door, sealing them in blackness, and shoved the crossbars into place. The children were crying. He felt for the lantern, took a box of matches from his pocket. His hands were trembling as he lit the wick. Pim was huddled with the children against the wall. Her eyes grew very wide.
"Where's Kate?"
From outside. A shot.
7. The Awakening. At the round earth's imagined corners, blow your trumpets, angels, and arise. Arise from death, you numberless infinities of souls. John Donne. Holy Sonnets. 55. Peter awoke to a clattering of branches dragging against the side of the Humvee. He shook off his sluggishness and sat up. "Where are we?"
"Houston," Greer said. Michael was asleep in the passenger seat. "Not long now."
A few minutes later, Greer brought the vehicle to a halt. To the east, the darkness had begun to soften.
"Let's be quick now," Greer said.
Peter and Michael unloaded their gear. They were at the edge of the lagoon. To the east, skyscrapers of incredible height cut black rectangles against the diminishing stars. Greer dragged a rowboat into the shallows. Michael sat in the bow, Peter the stern. Greer climbed into the middle, facing backward. The boat sank nearly to the gunwale, but remained afloat.
"I was a little worried about that," Greer confessed.
With broad strokes, he propelled them across the lagoon. Peter watched the city's core harden into its full dimensions. The Mariner soared into view, its great wide stern riding high above the water. Inside one Allen Center, they tied off, gathered their supplies, and began to climb. From a window on the 10th floor, they dropped to the deck. Dawn was a few minutes away. Greer had refurbished a small crane of a type once used to lower cargo over the side of the ship. He spread the net beneath it, tightened the spring on the spinner joint, and attached it to the rope that ran through the block at the end of the boom. A second rope would be used to swing the boom over the water. Greer would manage the first rope, Michael the second. Peter's job was to act as bait, Greer's theory being that Peter was the person Amy was least likely to kill. Greer handed him the wrench.
Remember, she's not the Amy we know. They took up their positions. Peter fit the tip of the wrench around the first bolt.
They're here, said Amy.
Carter was sitting across the table from her.
Feel it, too.
Her heart was racing. She felt a little dizzy.
It always came on like this, with a sensation of physical acceleration that culminated in an abrupt expulsion from one world to the next, as if she were a rock hurled from a sling.
I wish you were coming with me, she said.
Long as I'm here, they're safe. You know that.
She did. If Carter died, the dopies, his many, would die with him. Without them, Amy and Carter stood no chance. She looked around the garden one last time, saying goodbye. She closed her eyes.
Two bolts to go, one on each side. Peter loosened the first, leaving it in place. As he fit the head of the wrench around the second bolt, a massive force, like a giant fist, struck the hatch from the opposite side. The deck beneath his knees shuddered from the impact.
Amy, it's me. It's Peter.
Another whang. The loosened bolt popped from the hole and bounced across the deck. He had seconds to spare. With a final yank, he freed the last bolt and began to run. The hatch blew skyward. Amy alighted on the deck, compressing to a reptilian crouch. Her body was glossy and compact, annealed with hard muscle beneath the crystalline sheath of skin. Peter was standing just beyond the net. For a moment she seemed puzzled by her surroundings. Then her head slanted with a darting motion, taking him into her sights. She scuttled forward. Peter saw no recognition in her eyes. Amy. He lifted a hand toward her and spread his fingers. It's me. She halted, inches from the net. It's Peter. Rising, Amy stepped forward. Greer pulled the rope. The net engulfed her and shot upward, her weight freeing the spinner from its break. The net began to twirl faster and faster. Amy was screaming and thrashing in its grasp. Michael yanked the second rope, swinging the boom over the side of the ship. Greer let go. The rope holding the net shrieked through the block. Peter ran to the rail. He had just enough time to see the splash before Amy vanished into the oily water. Darkness. She was spinning and twisting and falling. Her senses swarmed with the awful chemical-tasting water. It filled her mouth. It filled her nose and eyes and ears, a grip of pure death. She touched down upon the mucky bottom. The net held her body fast in its tangle. She needed to breathe. To breathe! She was thrashing, clawing, but there was no escaping its grasp. The first bubble of air rose from her mouth. No, she thought. Don't breathe. This simple thing. To open one's lungs and take in the air. The body demanded it. A second bubble, and her throat opened and the water slammed into her. She began to choke. The world was dissolving. No, it was she who was dissolving. Her body felt untethered to her thoughts, a thing apart, no longer hers. Her heart began to slow. A new darkness came upon her. It spread from within. This is what it's like, she thought. Panic and pain, and then the letting go. This is what it's like to die. Then she was somewhere else. She was playing a piano. This was strange because she'd never learned. Yet here she was. Playing not just well, but expertly, fingers prancing across the keys. There was no sheet music before her. The song came from her head, a sad and beautiful song, full of tenderness and the sweet sorrows of life. Why did it seem entirely new to her, but also remembered, like something from a dream? As she played, she began to discern patterns in the notes. Their relationship was not arbitrary. They moved through discernible cycles. Each cycle carried a slight variation of the song's emotional core, a melodic line that never wholly departed, but supported the rest, like laundry on a string.
How astonishing! She felt as if she were speaking an entirely new language, far more subtle and expressive than ordinary speech, capable of communicating the deepest truths. It made her happy, very happy, and she went on playing, her fingers dexterously moving, her spirit soaring with delight.
The song turned a corner. She could sense its end approaching. The final notes descended. They hung like dust motes in the air, then were gone. That was wonderful. Peter was standing behind her. Amy leaned the back of her head against his chest.
"I didn't hear you come in," she said.
"I didn't want to disturb you. I know how much you like to play." "Will you play me another?" he asked.
"Would you like that?"
"Oh, yes," he said. "Very much."
"Pull her up," Peter yelled. Greer was looking at his watch.
"Not yet."
"God damn it, she's drowning!"
Greer continued looking at his watch with infuriating patience. At last, he looked up. "Now," he said. She played for a long while, song after song. The first was light, with a humorous energy. It made her feel as if she were at a gathering of friends, everyone talking and laughing, darkness thickening outside the windows as the party went on and on into the small hours of the night. The next one was more serious. It began with a deep, sonorous chord at the bass end of the keyboard, with a slightly sour tone. A song of regret, of acts that could not be recalled, mistakes that could never be undone. There were others. One was like looking at a fire, another like falling snow. A third was horses galloping through tall grass beneath a blue autumn sky. She played and played. There was so much feeling in the world, so much sadness, so much longing, so much joy. Everything had a soul, the petals of flowers, the mice of the field, the clouds and rain and the bare limbs of trees. All these things and many others were in the songs she played. Peter was still behind her. The music was for him, an offering of love. She felt at peace.
They swung the net over the side and lowered it to the deck. Greer drew a knife and began to slash at the filaments. In the net was the body of a woman.
"Hurry," Peter said.
Greer hacked away. He was fashioning a haul.
"Take her feet." Michael and Peter drew Amy free and laid her face up on the deck. The sun was rising. Her body was limp, with a bluish cast. On her head, a scrim of black hair. She wasn't breathing. Peter dropped to his knees. Michael straddled her at the waist, stacked his palms, and positioned them on Amy's sternum. Peter slid his left hand beneath her neck, lifting it slightly to open the airway. With his other hand, he pinched her nose. He fit his mouth over hers and blew.
"Amy."
Her fingers stilled, bringing a sudden silence to the room. She lifted her hands above the keyboard, palms flat, fingers extended.
"I need you to do something for me," Peter said.
She reached over her shoulder, took his left hand and placed it against her cheek. His skin was cold and smelled of the river, where he liked to spend his days. How wonderful everything was.
"Tell me."
"Don't leave me, Amy."
"What makes you think I'm going someplace?"
"It's not time yet."
"I don't understand."
"Do you know where you are?"
She wanted to turn around to see his face, and yet could not. "I do. I think I do.
we're at the farmstead.
Then you know why you can't stay. She was suddenly cold.
But I want to.
It's too soon.
I'm sorry.
She began to cough. I need you with me, Peter said. There are things we have to do. The coughing became more intense. Her whole body shook with it. Her limbs were like ice.
What was happening to her?
Come back to me, Amy. She was choking. She was going to vomit. The room began to fade. Something else was taking its place. A sharp pain struck her chest, like the blow of a fist. She doubled over, her body curling around the impact. Foul-tasting water poured from her mouth. Come back to me, Amy. Come back to me. Come back to me.
Amy's face was slack, her body still. Michael was counting out the compressions. 15, 20, 25.
God damn it, Greer, Peter yelled. She's dying!
Don't stop.
It's not working!
Peter bent his face to hers once more, pinched her nose, and blew. Something clicked inside her. Peter pulled away as her mouth opened wide in a throttled gasp. He rolled her over, slipped an arm beneath her torso to lift her slightly, and pounded her on the back. With a retching sound, water jetted from her mouth onto the deck.
There was a face. That was the first thing she became aware of. A face, its features vague, and behind it only sky. Where was she? What had occurred? Who was this person who was looking at her, floating in the heavens? She blinked, trying to focus her eyes. Slowly, the image resolved. A nose, the curving shape of ears, a broad, smiling mouth, and above it, eyes that glittered with tears. Pure happiness filled her like a bursting star. Oh, Peter, she said, raising a hand to his cheek. It is so good to see you.
8. The Siege. Thick as autumnal leaves or driving sand, the moving squadrons blacken all the strand. Homer, The Iliad. 56. All night long, the virals pounded. It happened in bursts. 5 minutes, 10, their fists and bodies slamming against the door. A period of silence. Then they would begin again. Eventually, the intervals between the attacks grew longer. The girls gave up their crying and slept, their heads buried in Pim's lap. More time passed, with no sounds outside. Finally, the virals did not return. Caleb waited. When would dawn come? When would it be safe to open the door? Pim, too, had fallen asleep. The terrors of the night had exhausted all of them. He leaned his head against the wall and closed his eyes. He awoke to muffled voices outside. Help had arrived. Whoever it was had begun to knock. Pim awoke. The girls were still asleep. She signed a simple question mark. It's people, he replied. Still, it was with some anxiety that he unbarred the door. He pushed it just a little. A crack of daylight blasted his eyes. He shoved the door open the rest of the way, blinking in the light. Standing before him, Sarah dropped to her knees.
Oh, thank God, she said.
Hollis was with her. The two were barefoot, soaked to the bone. We were coming to see you when they attacked, Hollis explained. We hid in the river. Pim lifted the children out and climbed up behind them. Sarah embraced her, weeping.
Thank God. Thank God.
She knelt and drew the girls into her arms.
You're safe. My babies are safe.
Caleb's relief melted away. He realized what was about to happen.
Kate, Sarah yelled. Come out now.
Nobody said anything.
Kate?
Hollis looked at Caleb. The younger man shook his head. Hollis stiffened, wavering on his feet, the blood draining from his face. For a moment, Caleb thought his father-in-law might collapse. Sarah, come here, Hollis said.
Kate?
Her voice was frantic.
Kate, come out!
Hollis grabbed her around the waist.
Kate, you answer me!
She's not in the hard box, Sarah. Sarah thrashed in his arms, trying to break free.
Hollis, let me go. Kate!
She's gone, Sarah. Our Kate is gone.
Don't say that. Kate, I'm your mother. You come out here right now.
Her strength left her. She dropped to her knees, Hollis still holding her around the waist.
Oh, God,
she moaned. Hollis's eyes were closed in anguish.
She's gone. She's gone. Please, no. Not her.
Our little girl is gone. Sarah lifted her face to the heavens. Then she began to howl. The light was soft and featureless. Low, wet clouds blotted the sun. Peter lifted Amy into the vehicle's cargo bay and put a blanket over her. A bit of color had flowed back into her face. Her eyes were closed, though it seemed she was not asleep, but rather in a kind of twilight, as if her mind were floating in a current, the banks of the world flowing past. Greer's voice was tight. We better get moving. Peter rode in the back with Amy. The going was slow, the dirt track crowded by brush. In the dark, Peter had absorbed almost nothing of the landscape. Now he saw it for what it was, an inhospitable swamp of lagoons, ruined structures clawed by vines, the earth vague, like something melted. Sometimes standing water obscured the roadway, its depth unknown. Greer plowed through. The foliage began to thin. A cyclonic tangle of highway overpasses appeared. Greer threaded through the detritus beneath the freeway, located a ramp, and ascended. For a time they followed the highway, then Greer veered away. Despite the violent jostling of the Humvee, Amy had yet to stir. They skirted a second region of collapsed overpasses, then climbed up the bank, back onto the highway. Michael turned in his seat. Easier going from here. Rain began to fall, pattering the windshield. Then the clouds broke, revealing a strong Texas sun. Amy gave a sigh of wakefulness. Peter looked to find that her eyes had opened. She blinked at him, then squinting fiercely, covered her eyes with her arms.
It's bright, she said.
What was that? Greer said from the front. She says it's bright. She's been in the dark for 20 years. The light may bother her a while. Greer bent forward to reach under his seat. Give her these. Over his shoulder, he passed Peter a pair of dark glasses. The lenses were scratched and pitted, the frames made from soldered wire. He slipped the glasses over her face, wrapping the wires gently behind her ears. Better? She nodded. Her eyes closed once more.
I'm so tired,
she murmured. Peter leaned forward. How much farther? We should make it before sundown, but it will be close. We're going to need fuel, too. There should be some in the hard box west of Sealy. They continued in silence. Despite the tension, Peter felt himself drifting off. He slept for 2 hours, awakening to find that the truck had stopped. Greer and Michael were toting 2 heavy plastic jugs of fuel from the hard box. His thoughts were fuzzy. His limbs, heavy and slow, moved like pooled liquid. Everywhere in his body, he felt his age. Michael glanced his way as he stepped out. How's she doing? Still asleep. Greer was pouring gas through a funnel into the truck's tank. She'll be okay. Sleep is what she needs. Let me take the wheel for a while, Peter offered. I know the way from here. Greer bent to cap the can and wiped his hands on his shirt. Better if Michael does for now.
There's a few tricky spots ahead.
They found Kate at the edge of the woods. The gun was still in her hand, her finger curled inside the trigger guard. One shot through the sweet spot. Kate, thorough to the last, had wanted to be sure. They had no time to bury her. They decided to take her into the house and lay her in the bed Caleb and Pim had shared, since they would never be coming back here. Hollis and Caleb carried her inside. It did not seem right to leave her in her blood-stained clothes. Pim and Sarah undressed her, washed her body, and put her in one of Pim's nightgowns, made of soft blue cotton. They placed a pillow beneath her head and tucked a blanket tightly around her. Pim, weeping silently, brushed her sister's hair. A final question. Should they let the girls see her? Yes, Sarah said. Kate was their mother. They needed to say goodbye. Caleb waited outside. It was mid-morning, cruelly bright. Nature mocked him with its disregard. The birds sang, the breeze blew, the clouds scudded overhead, the sun moved in its lazy, fateful arc. Handsome lay dead in the field. A crowd of buzzards jabbed at the banquet of his flesh, flapping their enormous wings. All was a ruin, yet the world did not seem to know or care. In the bedroom, Caleb had told Kate he loved her and kissed her on the forehead. Her skin was shockingly cold, but that was not the most disturbing thing. He realized he was expecting her to say something. It didn't hurt too much. Or, it's okay, Caleb, I don't blame you. You did the best you could. Maybe she would say something sarcastic, such as, seriously? You're gonna tuck me into bed? I'm not a child, you know. I bet this is a lot of fun for you, Caleb. Yet there was nothing. Her body existed, but all that had made her distinct as a person was absent. Her voice was gone. Never would it be heard again. Pim came out first, with the girls. Elle was crying softly. Bug looked merely confused. A few minutes passed before Sarah and Hollis emerged. If you're ready, we should get moving, Caleb said. Hollis nodded. Sarah, standing apart, was gazing toward the trees. Her eyes were glassy, her face unnaturally still, as if some essential element of life had left it. She cleared her throat and spoke.
Husband, will you do something for me?
All right. She looked him in the eye. Kill every last fucking one of them. The going was slow. Soon all three children were being carried. Bug on Caleb's shoulders, Elle on her grandfather's back, Theo in his sling, Pim and Sarah taking turns. They were deep into the afternoon by the time they reached town. The streets were devoid of life. In Elakwa's yard, they found the truck, still parked where Caleb had seen it. Caleb got in the driver's seat. He'd hoped the key would be in the ignition, but it wasn't. He searched the cab to no avail and climbed back out. Do you know how to hotwire a truck? He asked Hollis. Not really. Caleb looked toward the house. A window on the top floor was broken, smashed from its frame. Glass and splintered wood littered the ground beneath it. Somebody's going to have to go inside to look. I'll do it, said Hollis. This is my responsibility. Stay here. Caleb left the rifle with Hollis and took the revolver. The air in the house was so still it felt unbreathed. He crept from room to room, opening drawers and cabinets. Finding no keys, he climbed the stairs. There were two rooms with closed doors on either side of a narrow hall. He opened the first door. Here was where Elakwa and his wife had slept. The bed was unmade. Beside it, lace curtains shifted slightly in the breeze coming through the broken window. He searched all the drawers, then stepped to the window and waved down. Hollis gazed up with a questioning look. Caleb shook his head.
One room to go. What if they couldn't find the keys? He'd seen no other vehicles in town. That didn't mean there weren't any, but they were running out of time. Caleb took a breath and pushed the door with his foot. Ilaqua was lying on the bed, fully clothed. The room reeked of piss and rancid breath. At first, Caleb thought the man was dead, but then he gave a wet snort and rolled onto his side. An empty whiskey bottle stood on the floor beside the bed. The man wasn't dead, just dead drunk. Caleb shook him roughly by the shoulders. "Wake up." Ilaqua, eyes still closed, batted clumsily at Caleb's hand. "Leave me alone," he mumbled. "Dr. Ilaqua, it's Caleb Jackson. Pull yourself together." His tongue moved heavily in his mouth. "You bitch." Caleb had a sense of what had occurred. Cast out from his marital bed, the man had anesthetized himself into oblivion and missed the whole thing. Perhaps he'd been drunk to begin with, and that was why his wife had sent him packing. In either case, Caleb practically envied him. The disaster had passed him by. How had the virals missed him? Maybe he just smelled too bad. Maybe that was the solution. Maybe they should all get drunk and stay that way. He shook Ilaqua again. The man's eyes fluttered open. They roamed blearily, finally landing on Caleb's face. "Who the hell are you?" There was no point in attempting to explain the situation. The man was too far gone. "Dr. Ilaqua, look at me. I need the keys to your truck." Caleb might have been asking him the most incomprehensible question in the world. "Keys?" "Yes, the keys. Where are they?" His eyes lost focus. He closed them again, his head, with its wild mane of hair, relaxing into the pillow. Caleb realized there was one place he hadn't looked. The man's trousers were soaked with urine, but there was nothing to be done about that. Caleb patted him down. At the base of the man's left front pocket, Caleb felt something sharp. He slid his hand in and pulled it out. A single key, tarnished with age, on a small metal ring. "Gotcha." His thoughts were broken by the roar of engines coming down the street. Caleb went to the window. Sarah and the others were waving frantically toward the source of the sound, yelling, "Hey, over here!" Caleb stepped onto the porch as the trucks, three Army 5-tons, halted in front of the house. A broad-chested man in uniform stepped from the cab of the first truck. Gunner Apgar. "Caleb, thank God." They shook. Hollis and Sarah had joined them. Apgar looked the group over. "Is this all of you?" "There's one more in the house, but we'll need some help getting him out. He's pretty drunk." "You're kidding." When Caleb said nothing, Apgar addressed a pair of soldiers who had disembarked from the second vehicle. "Haul him out here on the double." They trotted up the steps. "We've been working our way west, looking for folks," Apgar said. "How many survivors have you found?" "You're it. We're not even finding any bodies. The virals either dragged them off or they've been turned." Hollis asked, "What about Kerrville?" "No sign of them yet. Whatever's going on, it's happening out here first." He paused, his expression suddenly uncertain. "There's something else you ought to know, Caleb. It's about your father." Peter took the wheel east of Seguin. Amy had awakened briefly in mid-afternoon, asking for water. Her fever was down, and her eyes seemed to be bothering her less, though she complained of a headache and was still very weak. Squinting out a side window, she asked how much farther they had to go. She was wearing the blanket like a shawl over her head and shoulders. 3 hours, Greer said, maybe 4. Amy considered this answer, then said very softly,
"We should hurry."
They crossed the Guadalupe and turned north. The first township they'd come to was just east of the old city of Burney. It wasn't much, but there was a telegraph station. Only 2 hands of daylight remained when they pulled into the small central square. "Awfully quiet around here," Michael said.
The streets were empty. Odd for this hour, Peter thought. They disembarked into ghostly silence. The town comprised just a few buildings.